All right. Did that answer your question? I've lost track of what the question was.
Yeah. Okay. How you work with different community organizations.
Yeah. So in part, it, you know, it's hopefully my effort to contribute some time and energy to on the groundwork, but it also keeps my own work grounded. Mm-hmm. I pick up issues, you know, try to bring in the types of resources and skills that they don't have the time to do themselves. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of how I see it.
Yeah. And I also think that you're, when I talked to a lot of different community organizers, they were saying, oh, we need more academics in the field because all of us are on the ground and there's no actual academic material being produced.
Yeah.
Because when I looked for literature and things like that, there's a lot on Black women, Latina women.
Yeah.
But there's nothing
hardly any
on Asian American women.
I know at one point Yin and I had this dream that we were going to create a history of like an RJ history of Asian American women. But there's no documentation. Like there is for African American women, because there have long been historians who've been working in that field. Mm. And there, we thought, we looked for data on abortion and all kinds of issues, and we can't find anything. Mm. So, you know, we'd have to go out and find the people, interview the people.
Just what I'm doing.
Yeah, exactly. We need people like you.
Yeah, I looked for it, too, because I wanted to...
Did you find anything?
No. I found Laura Jo Fu's book.
Yeah.
And then I found Undivided Rights, and that was it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and then I found you, and it was, like, a couple articles, and then and that was it, yeah.
Yeah, there's hardly anything out there, and I thought, God, I would love to be able to go out and interview people, but I don't have... From a if you're not an anthropologist or a sociologist,
yeah,
it's really hard to do that.
Yeah, definitely.
So I could start now, but I wouldn't be able to get around to collecting enough material but till I retire. Then it could be my retirement project. I really need somebody who's been trained to do it.
Yeah. But it's good. I think it's good that I'm like interviewing the people who are actually doing the work right now, because
yeah,
it's more alive and it's more fresh.
Yeah.
And so yeah, their memories are a little better.
I mean, for a while I had a fantasy of tracking down the doctors who were providing services, because there was a doctor in LA, mm-hmm, who was a woman doctor who practiced in LA. She delivered my aunt, she delivered one of my students, but she was working primarily in South Central.
Mm-hmm.
So she must have been delivering babies and performing abortions for primarily women of color,
mm-hmm,
for decades.
Right.
For decades, because she was one of the first Asian women doctors.
Oh, wow.
So her life must have been fascinating, and she must have had she must have known what was going on.
Yeah.
But by the time I figured out who she was like in her 90s.
Oh, no.
And I was no longer in L.A.
Oh. Yeah, and then the history just kind of disappears.
Yeah, maybe somebody got it. I don't know.
Yeah, hopefully, well, this project will hopefully, like...
I know.
Once it's in the archive, someone will look for it.
Yeah, it's great that you're doing this.
Yeah, I also wanted to kind of move on to your experience with the RJ for All conference in Smith.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
If you could just tell me, like, what the conference was about, what it was like, and who was there. That was a while ago.
It seemed like everybody was there, or nearly everybody was there. So in that sense, it was this wonderful gathering. It was, because mm-hmm, it was people, it was activists, and it was scholars.
Mm.
So there was a lot of synergies there, a lot of excitement. It was one of the first, I think, conferences using the reproductive justice framework.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't the only one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was really telling that the RJ framework came from the movement and not academia. And it gave academics a chance to sort of appreciate that. So I think that was really good. But it was a really good mix of people. Not absolutely everybody could make it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a real mix of issues. It wasn't just abortion. It was also disability rights a little bit, probably not enough, and the queer activists were there. So sexual orientation, sexual identity, those issues were on the table. And it was one of the few times where I've been to a reproductive rights, reproductive health type of setting where those things came together. It wasn't more narrowly focused. And the goal was to sort of open up those spaces rather than say, this is what we can do in 2 days.
So what was kind of the final product of the conference?
I know they tried to document as much as possible. My guess is that there wasn't a final product, but it did. Like, one example was that the panel, one of the panels I was on, we decided to use that as a starting point, and so we produced a set of articles that were published in Science. And so it allowed us to continue. There were a couple, there was at least one meeting following that, which I wasn't able to attend in person. But it sort of, so it was a basis of a new set of relationships, at least. And I think that's been true for other people as well. Yeah.
Who were the other Asian American women that were there?
Yin was there.
Really?
So that's an example. You know, she's, you know, she's someone who's been long been doing work on the ground, and she was there, and that was really important. Who else was there? For Asian American women. Well, Wendy Mink was one of the organizers.
Oh, who's that?
So she's at Smith. So she was one of the core faculty members who put it together. So Gwendolyn Mink.
Okay, I don't know her.
She does really great work. Her primary work's in welfare, but she does really great race gender analysis of welfare. So she was, in a sense, one of the hosts who helped pull it together, and she was really key in that process. And she's also, she was selfless in the way she did it. She didn't sort of put herself front and center. And so maybe that's why you don't know her name, but she was key to that coming together.
Yeah.
At that conference. So she's Asian American. I'm trying to think. It's so funny because it was probably much less about race. I mean, because there was a racial analysis there, but because it was so open, I know Dorothy Roberts was there. She's not Asian American. I'm just trying to remember all the faces I saw. I can't remember.
It was just a lot of people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was Marlene. Marlene was there. I don't remember. I just remember lots of people were there. Evelyn wasn't there. I remember I called her from there.
Okay.
Planned Parenthood was there. That was amazing. Because to have one of the sort of major, you know, national women's organizations that had been for so long white and law focused, they're embracing the, or at least saying they were embracing the reproductive justice framework, was really important. But the Asian American women, I can't identify specifically. Yeah, it's all pretty fuzzy.
I can just dig through the archives.
I guess you can remind me who was there. Yeah, I don't remember a lot of specifics about it.
Yeah. Were there any other, like, seminal gatherings or any key events that you remember? You said there were some other reproductive justice conferences.
In terms of academic conferences?
Yeah, sure.
Let's see. You know, the Color of Justice conference, that was at Santa Cruz.
Okay, do you remember when that was?
Let me look it up. I think they have an archive too. If not, I might have materials from that.
Was that a law conference?
No.
This is so long ago.
Is it the 90s?
Oh, it was Color of Violence. Is that Color of Justice or Color of Violence? Maybe this is it.
Oh, the Insight Conference?
Okay. Maybe this was it. That looks familiar.
Yeah, that was a pretty big conference.
What was the date? I think this was it. I think this is the one I'm thinking of. That one was, it wasn't solely focused on reproductive justice, but there was definitely a reproductive justice thread there.
Mm-hmm.
I just can't remember when it was. But that was another one.
What else? A lot of the stuff that, well, LSRJ, I mean, when they switched from law students to reproductive choice to law students for reproductive justice, I think that was an important shift. And they've hosted it some, I think, important events, one at Berkeley,
mm-hmm.
at Berkeley Law. And their trainings, I think, are good. Other big events. I know, it's just so interesting now because reproductive justice, I think, has become so frequently used now that it's lost some of its political meaning.
Yeah, that's what happens.
Yeah, I mean, even there was a really interesting, they got an NSF-funded workshop, and it was hosted by Jennifer Fishman, Laura Mamo, and I'm losing the third person. Janet Shim. Do you know them?
No.
So they're in sociology.
Okay.
But they hosted this in San Francisco, so it was like a workshop.
Mm-hmm.
And that was focused on reproductive justice.
Mm-hmm.
So it was it was much more limited. We could all meet in one room.
Yeah.
But we met for 2 days with pretty intense discussions.
And was it scholars?
Was it all scholars? I'm trying to think of who was there. All the people I can think of were primarily scholars. Some people doing a mix of both.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was primarily scholars. But that was a really, what they did was they merged, they had RJ and EJ.
Mm-hmm. That's always good.
Yeah, and it was really, really interesting to see sort of the different uses of the word justice and different understandings,
mm-hmm.
And the sort of different evolutions,
mm-hmm.
And paths that those two framings have followed. So I think that was a really useful discussion,
mm-hmm.
at least within the academic world.
Yeah.
They had a lot of the key people there.
Yeah. This is just kind of like a personal question that I was like interested in, but why do you think it's so important to have like law students, or why do you think so many law students are interested in like reproductive justice, that there's a national organization around it?
Oh yeah. I think a lot of, that's a good question, let's see. I think there is a, maybe it's, you know, there's a, maybe it shows sort of the ways in which critical theory and feminist critical theory have influenced, I think, both undergraduate education but also and legal education, but probably also the way that community work is done.
Mm-hmm.
Students come in with an awareness, and I think are at least open to learning that you can only do so much with law.
Mm-hmm.
And so they want a way of thinking, a way of thinking about issues that gets them beyond the limitations of legalistic approaches,
mm-hmm.
and RJ can do that.
Are, is the organization mostly made up of like women, or are there a lot of like male allies?
LSRJ?
Yeah,
I think it's, well, the staffing is primarily women. I think most of the members in the different law schools mm-hmm. are women. It's not limited to women. But their primary goal has been to get courses in the law school's curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
And to provide sites within the law schools for students and faculty mm-hmm. to work on the issues, to be trained to address the issues,
mm-hmm.
And then participate in the broader movement in various ways.
Yeah. Do they go out after they graduate law school and, like, when they practice law, is, like, RJ something they kind of, like...
Yeah, some of them do, partly because... So some of them are getting fellowships. So Christine right here is one of my former students, and she was head of LSRJ when she was here.
Oh.
She got an LSRJ fellowship. She did an, I think she did one of their summer training programs and then got an LSRJ fellowship that placed her at NOPOF in D.C. So that's what she's doing now.
Oh.
So she's doing RJ stuff
mm-hmm.
Post-graduation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she wants to continue doing that.
Yeah.
There are tons of jobs.
It's a really narrow
field. Reproductive justice,
yeah.
But I think they're much better equipped and much more likely to find those jobs if they're getting the courses and finding the support system
mm-hmm.
while they're in law school.
Mm-hmm. That's really cool. Yeah, I'm like trying to figure out what I want to do after college.
So. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that might be something I would be interested in.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a great group of people.
Mm-hmm. Well, since you're so familiar with like law and stuff, I haven't been able to ask as many people, but do you know any of key legislations or like policies that that I should probably include in the timeline?
Well, there's this whole ramping up in abortion regulation right now. I get an email about that every single day.
I have no idea what's going on in this country. We're always on the defensive, right?
Oh my gosh.
I don't know what's going
it's
on.
Crazy. It's crazy. Yeah, so, just the ramping up in abortion regulation, and it is...
What do you think has happened?
I guess, I don't know. I mean, everybody's talking about the polarization.
Yeah.
Not just between the, you know, official political parties, but the sort of cultural political polarization. It's interesting, because I think the agenda is not just about... fetal politics anymore. It's really about the status of women. It's much more directly aimed at women's decision-making powers. It's really sort of trying to narrow down the scope of women's decision-making powers. But it's also very closely linked to a broader agenda. So the same, you know, the attacks on women's right and women's status is linked to same-sex marriage, the attacks on same-sex marriage. I don't think that's a coincidence that those two fights are taking place simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I don't have, you know, the perfect answer to what's going on. And the interesting thing is at the same time that there's all this sort of effort to contract choice with respect to abortion, assisted reproductive technology use is almost wholly unregulated. So this notion that, oh, free choice is perfectly appropriate in that sphere. So we're using a free market approach to those kinds of technologies.
Well, there's definitely a class difference between the two.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So, like, the users of technologies, they're not, like, bad mothers who need abortion or, you know, who are making unfit to make those choices.
Yeah, it's primarily, not exclusively, it's primarily white, it's primarily privileged. You have to have
a lot of money.
Credit and cash to use those technologies. They have powerful industries behind them because
mm-hmm.
it's a multi-billion dollar industry in the U.S. and now it's global.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pronatalist. You know, one of the things now is to, in California, there's a bill, I think it's close to enactment, to authorize payment for eggs for research purposes.
Okay.
So we already have an unregulated market for paying women to provide eggs for fertility purposes, but mm-hmm. there's been regulation of payment to provide eggs for research purposes.
Right.
But now they're trying to authorize payment for eggs for research purposes.
Oh.
So it'll expand the market there.
Wow.
So expansion of the market approach.
It's only going to get bigger then.
Maybe. Maybe not. But there's no immediate breaks on it.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I'm not, like, very familiar with, like, the legislation or, like, the policies on reproductive technologies.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that's going on is that there's still, I mean, there was just a story in the paper yesterday about the forced sterilizations taking place in, or the
prison.
Yeah, the involuntary
like
sterilizations taking place.
Yeah, I clipped the entire thing. I was like, this looks like an article that I was reading from, like, the 80s
exactly.
or the 70s. Yeah.
Exactly. Because there's a group of people working to try to get redress for those who were subject to the forced sterilizations in California as part of eugenic sterilization.
Right.
But now there's this whole other group of people.
Oh my gosh.
It hasn't stopped.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because I don't know if this is true, but a lot of the discussion I feel like is shifting from race to like crime or immigration status, and it's kind of like hiding the race factor.
Yeah.
Because race is some kind of like taboo thing we're not allowed to like directly discriminate people
yeah.
on. But it's okay to discriminate people on immigration status or, you know, criminal history.
Yeah.
But people kind of erase the fact that it's connected directly to race.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
Like
well, immigration restrictions have long been understood as a way of population control
mm-hmm.
by race.
Right.
So that's been true since the early 20th century.
Yeah.
And that's part of what the debate is about now with respect to immigration reform.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's not just it's not just specifically about, you know, the technology uses, but also things like marriage and immigration.
Right.
Are
that's
related as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Cuz yeah. it's all about the nuclear family, like the technology and then the immigration, birth control, like abortion, it's all about that's really interesting.
Yeah, and I think it's important to remember it's also about gender roles.
Mm-hmm.
The fight's still on about gender roles. I know, it seems like it shouldn't be, but it still is.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Okay, so those are the policies that are, like, right now. But what about some key policies or legislations, and like, in the past, like, in the 80s or 90s? Are you familiar with any or things that, like, stick out?
Oh, from the 80s and 90s?
Mm-hmm.
Well, 80s and 90s are things that, you know, surfaced were prosecution of pregnant women for drug use,
mm-hmm.
and still the way that pregnant women are treated, especially criminalization,
mm-hmm.
Is still, it's that trend has continued. Now it's criminalization of women for anything that causes fetal injury or death. So it's expanded in some senses.
Okay.
That was a lot of it. The reproductive technology uses
were
really booming then.
When was the Hyde Law?
That started in, Hyde Amendment was a reaction to Roe versus Wade, so that came up in the late 1970s.
70s, okay.
Yeah, and it's changed over time. It's sort
mm-hmm.
of, you know, and what's changed about it is a list of exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's also multiplied, so there are different Hyde Laws. So it applies to members of the military, it applies to other sources of federal funding as well, because
mm-hmm.
the Hyde Amendment itself only applies to Medicaid funding.
Mm-hmm.
But now there's sort of Hyde-like laws that apply to other federally funded forms of health care.
Yeah, yeah. Are you also familiar with PRENDA?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, could you talk a little bit about that and sex election, Asian American women?
Yeah. That stuff's getting really nutty. Yeah, so it's all in the name of, I mean, they say it's about protecting women and protecting women of color
rhetoric?
Specifically.
Yeah.
You know what? It's just, yeah, it's crazy. So it's all in the name of protecting women, but it's sort of, it's you know, regulation of women in another form, really.
Mm-hmm.
They couched it in the form of racial, I guess, anti-discrimination.
Yeah.
Which is clever. Yeah, so between that the billboards.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You get all these different, there's this women protectionist movement, so we need to restrict abortion in order to protect women against themselves. Reva Siegel's done some of the best work on that. And then, yeah, then now they're using the anti-discrimination, anti-race discrimination framework. So it's, I think the focus on the fetus has shifted to these other rationales or narratives about what the regulation's for.
Has the PRENDA law, like, passed in some states?
The last one I heard about was in Arizona, and I think it was defeated.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, another person you should talk to, Sujatha.
Oh, yes.
Did you talk to her?
No, I have her scheduled in 2 weeks.
So she has she's really knowledgeable on this issue.
Yeah, she used to work with Generations Ahead.
Yeah, yeah. So, and she's still doing great work.
Yeah, I think she's at UCSF.
Yeah.
Coraline.
Yeah. Yeah, but Generations Ahead put together a really good analysis of the sex selection, the supposed race selection laws.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so she's the person to really talk to about that.
Yeah. I mean, your commentary is helpful too, so.
Yeah, and I think the other important front is, well, Sujatha is also going to be good on this. There's only emerging now a sort of an ability to talk between the disability rights and reproductive rights people, because they're going to be in conflict on some issues. So, from a disability rights perspective, you know, there's a lot of concern about choosing abortion because of Down syndrome or any other disability.
Right.
So it's really important to acknowledge those conflicts and try to work together to the extent possible. But that's that's very recent and it's just starting to happen and may not have gotten very far.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
What do you see as the possible compromises that they could come up with?
I probably haven't thought enough about this one. I mean, I think at least the conversation can start about acknowledging that there are different understandings of choice on the table. Mm-hmm. So I think my concern about sort of pro-choice at any cost is that it's morphed into a kind of free market choice, that it's no longer a sort of a thoughtful, autonomy-based choice anymore. And I think that puts communities like persons with disabilities at greater risk. So I think we have to start by acknowledging that.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. Yeah, I don't know.
So that's like a potential.
Yeah, I think it's where, how do we start the conversation is hard enough.
Do you know if there were any like convenings of RJ and like disability rights activists?
Well, Sujatha's done some of that work.
Oh, okay.
So Generations Ahead did some of that work.
Mm-hmm.
And then Center for Genetics and Society held a series of 3 meetings. I miss it this year because this is the first year without it. The Tarrytown meetings, and the last 2 meetings, there were conversations about that that I think were very good and searching and I think honest. Difficult.
Yeah.
But I think open and willing in spirit.
So that's like one potential future conflict that you foresee for RJ.
Yeah, or maybe I don't even want to frame it as a conflict, but I think it's an important area of work that RJ needs to
Where
take
else
on.
Do you think what other issues do you think will come up for RJ, like the RJ movement?
The next few years. Well, the technology issues are moving really fast.
What's kind of the current status of art?
Let's see. So a lot, some of it's taking place in genetic testing because it's moving to really early stages of the pregnancy. And so...
Like how early?
First trimester. Early in the first trimester. Yeah, you can now do genetic testing.
How exactly does that work?
And get, and presumably you'll get more and more information. Well, because now they can do, rather than an amniocentesis, which you usually do at like 18 to 20 weeks, so during the second trimester, and there's nothing wrong with doing it earlier, but you're getting more information, and there's no thoughtful analysis, as far as I know, about how to use that information.
Right.
So, and then the amount of information that you'll be able to get will increase over time. And so people are facing choices that they may not be prepared for and don't know how to think about. I don't think I would. So they're just presented as choices for people to have. So that's an issue.
So when you say genetic testing, it means like, oh, your son or daughter is a carrier of X-ray disease, and they have a percentage of, you know, developing kidney failure.
Like developing breast cancer when they're 50 or... And so it's the kinds of their risks as opposed to conditions that the child will be born with.
Right.
And so we're expanding the sort of ways of tailoring people.
So when they offer genetic testing, like, they say, okay, here's the risk for your child, like, then what are the options? Like, do you want to abort your child? Is that the option that they're providing?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, if it's prenatal. We also, you know, you can screen gametes to some extent. You can screen embryos, in vitro embryos, but most of the testing takes place during pregnancy.
Oh, wow.
And so, on the one hand, you're providing more and more opportunities to get information about the genetic content of an embryo or fetus. And on the other hand, we have this massive attempt to regulate pregnancy, so you can't do anything with the information.
Oh my gosh.
So, you know, part of it's the genetic, what's going on in genetics. Part of it's what's going on in the ART market. There's probably not enough attention being paid to contraceptives. There's a lot of research being done in contraceptives, in the world of contraceptives, so new forms of contraception will come onto the market.
Can you give us like a sneak peek of like what's coming?
No, I know I'm not a scientist in that sense, but it's only come on the table, I think, because of the fight about the Affordable Care Act and whether or not that should be an essential health benefit, part of the package that employers regularly cover. But it looks like now that's going to be a fight, and has been a fight for the past couple of years.
Right.
So, so contraceptives seems like old hat, but it's coming back. So that's back on the table.
Yeah.
So.
And before, you were talking a little bit about globalization of like the market.
Oh yeah.
Like reproductive technology.
Oh yeah. Because the reproductive technologies and the genetic, I assume the genetic testing stuff is, well, to some extent it is. It's you can go to a different jurisdiction to obtain access to any of these technology uses.
Okay.
So the U.S. and California in particular is both a major destination spot. So a lot of people come here.
Oh wow. Okay.
To use these technologies. In large part because they're as available as the market makes them here. We have few regulations that restrict access to them. And then a lot of people from the U.S., because those technologies are expensive here, they go to other countries. And so people are traveling from and to countries all over the world.
Wow. What are some of those destinations for U.S. people who are seeking out cheaper alternatives?
So it shifts. It depends on, because the market's shifting. So Mexico's a destination. I think Argentina's positioning itself to become one because I think they just passed a surrogacy law. So South America's opening up, Latin America's opening up. In Europe, Spain and Eastern Europe are really big. There's a lot in Asia, so Japan's very restrictive, so people from Japan going out. So part of it depends on who restricts it, where the technology is feasible, what the cost factors are.
Because it seems like really it needs to balance, because you need a certain level of development that you need, you have the technology to do it, but you can't.
And you have to have the experts.
So developed that, that it's expensive.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just, people are moving all over the place. South Africa's a destination. And people go to different countries for specific things. So India's received a lot of attention as a surrogacy market.
Right. I've seen those pictures.
Yeah.
Of like Indian women just like sitting in a row.
Yeah.
It's very like weird.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, world.
But a lot of people come to the U.S. for surrogacy as well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I think people go to, if you're white, you go to Eastern Europe, Spain. People from all over come to the U.S. because we have diversity here. Mm-hmm. So if you're looking for a particular color baby, then you shop on that basis. but you can take your embryos with you and undergo in vitro fertilization or surrogacy somewhere else.
Yeah. So instead of like traditional, it'd be like gestational surrogacy.
Yeah. So it's really crazy.
Yeah. I mean, are there any like racial or like, I mean, I'm sure there's class conflicts, but isn't it weird to have like a white couple come in to an Indian woman and have her have a white child?
Yeah.
Isn't that kind of
a Yeah. But it's also, you know, it's the privilege of the people from England, say, right, going to India, where the amount that a woman can make being a surrogate is greater than the amount of money she can make doing anything else if she lacks a lot of formal education.
Right.
And if she wants to, you know, support her kids and her family, then that's the best economic opportunity. So they're, in a sense, taking advantage of sort of limited opportunities for women in that country to get cheaper surrogacy.
Yeah, but because I've heard the opposite argument that people kind of justify their actions, saying, oh, you know, it's her choice to do it.
Yeah.
And
I'm helping them out.
Money. Exactly. It's like an independent woman making her own money.
Yeah.
And she can, like, put it in her own bank account.
Yeah. And I think that's true, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. And then there are some, I've heard, you know, some people say, well, they come to the U.S. because we're better at the technology, but price tag attached to it signifies that it's also better in quality. So some people are actually willing to pay more because they think it connotes a better, you know, a better outcome or something. So
what, like, how many of the people in our world are using these technologies?
I don't know. I know the U.S. measures for the industry, which look at like the revenues generated. It's a multi-billion dollar within the U.S. But the numbers, I don't know. The numbers globally, I don't know. There's a European organization which tracks some technology use. There's some studies in Canada which have tracked it. And there is, you can sort of get some data in the U.S. through the CDC, Centers for Disease Control. But then you still have to make some inferences and jumps about it. But it's still increasing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Because I haven't met a test tube baby, you know, like, friend yet. Like, my generation.
Oh.
Right?
Really?
Yeah, at least I haven't, or they've never disclosed it to me.
Yeah, maybe that's the difference.
But I know we're talking about it all the time. These issues come up, and they're like, you know, like, this neighbor, like, had a child via in vitro fertilization, and they would talk about it, but I just haven't met a kid my age yet who's done that. So maybe it's a little younger.
No, maybe. It also might be, it's a lot of people don't tell their kids. So it might be that, my guess is that that was more true 20 years ago than it is now. So it might be that you are sitting next to a test tube baby, but that you don't know. But it's, you know, the use of it's really increased over the years, so it's much more likely now that of the kids being born now that some form of technology was used than it was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But 20 years ago, that was late 90s, so, right?
Yeah.
Early to mid 90s.
Yeah, because I was born in 91.
Yeah, so. Oh my God.
Early 90s.
At least you're born in the 20th century.
Right.
So it was definitely being used then. Yeah, surrogacy, gestational surrogacy. There was a clear marker for that. In vitro fertilization, definitely. There was an egg market then, although it's much, much bigger now. There was definitely a sperm market.
I want to talk a little bit about that egg and sperm market too.
Okay.
Because even in like the Brown Daily Herald, which is our newspaper, there's articles that says like SAT 2100.
How much are they offering?
They were offering 8,000 to 10,000.
Yeah.
For Ivy League students, fit, Asian, woman.
Oh yeah.
And I was looking and I'm like, I could make $10,000.
Oh yeah, yeah. There's a premium on Asian eggs because there's relatively few donors and people are coming from overseas.
So it's Asian couples looking for Asian eggs.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. As far as I know. Mm-hmm. That's it. And people from other countries as well as in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So there's high demand.
Oh.
And it's the prices go up with demand for eggs.
Yeah, that's a little weird.
It is weird because it's trait pricing.
Yeah.
The industry rhetoric is that, no, we're paying for time and energy contributed to this, but the pricing is based on traits of the donors.
Right.
Yeah.
Because they give, like, a list of requirements, and they're, like, clean medical history and this and that.
Yeah.
It's just a little weird, because they're just looking for Asian women, like, Asian eggs.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's separate eggs for, like, Jewish eggs, you know, everything you could think of. As well. If you want to do something fun on the way back on the train, get on a Google California Cryobank.
Okay.
Because that's one of the biggest sperm banks in the world. Cryobank. California Cryobank.
How do you spell the second word?
CRYO.
Okay.
BANK.
Okay.
So it's a sperm bank.
Yeah.
So their marketing will astonish you.
Is it profiles of people?
Yeah.
Pictures?
Yeah, and you can also do celebrity look-alike donors.
Why is that necessary?
don't know.
That's so weird.
It is. That's how crazy it is.
Is there like a gender difference between sperm donors and egg donors?
Yeah, so Renee Almeling has done great work on this. She's a sociologist at Yale. Mm-hmm. So she's interviewed both the banks and also people who've done it. So. And there's Jennifer Haylett is a grad student here, and she's done really interesting work. So Jennifer's done work showing that there's an elaborate screening process for most sperm and egg banks. Mm-hmm. And the screening process serves to get them information to decide who's going to be appropriate, but it also is a socialization process mm-hmm. for those who are providing them. So in a sense, they're helping you figure out how to think about what you're doing if you become an egg donor or a sperm donor. Mm-hmm. So sperm donors, this is Renee Almeling's work, characterize their work as, or characterize sperm donation as work, as like a job.
Right.
That's what guys do, they go to work.
Okay.
But egg donors are much more likely to frame it in altruistic terms. They're helping somebody, it's a gift.
Oh.
It's a gift of life or a gift of family.
Huh.
Even though they're receiving a lot more money
than
sperm donors, and theoretically they're going through a lot more risk and time and work than they are, but it's gendered.
Wow.
Yeah, the way it's presented to the public, and I think the way it's presented to those who are participating in it is very gendered.
I actually did, my paper was on that. It was about framing like surrogacy as a choice, so not egg donation, like surrogacy for traditional surrogates and then gestational surrogates, and how It used to be that like privileged like white women would do it for their sisters or like their neighbors, and they would do it for free, but then receive, you know, monetary compensation after the fact as like a thank you. And then now it's still framed as like a choice, like, oh, these women still do it as a choice, and then ignoring like the class and the racial impact.
Yeah.
The gestational surrogates go through. So yeah, it's like really interesting. Freaky.
Yeah, and I heard there's been a lot of news coverage about the surrogacy agencies are really targeting military wives.
Oh, I've heard that too.
Yeah. And I haven't seen anything about the numbers, but it makes sense because if you're going to be in place for a year, what kind of career could you build? And you could register for school, but then you're going to have to transfer.
Yeah.
So, and if you've got kids, then you can stay at home.
Right. And then just the money itself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're contributing to the family's income. Mm-hmm. So they're healthy. They tend to be healthy, young.
Oh, wow. Do you think that market's going to, like, only further expand?
As far as I know, there doesn't seem to be any great push to stop surrogacy.
Wow.
Yeah. And I think it's been, you know, so many celebrities are so now open about it in a sense they've helped make it acceptable.
Oh, you mean that they're using surrogates?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think it'll ever get to the point where, you know, the fear that a lot of people have is that, you know, rich people will use other women to just have babies so that it doesn't, like, affect their figure or...
I don't know.
The pain.
I know people were talking about that in the 1980s,
yeah,
that, you know, what this was going to do was... you could, you know, it's a subcontracting model, right?
Yeah.
You could contract that out. I don't know. Because there's also a glamorization of pregnancy, too. Kind of a valorization of women who've gone through birth.
Mm-hmm.
And in, you know, the celebrity world, not only gone through birth, but gotten their figures back, too.
Beyonce.
I know. Exactly. So, I don't know. I mean, I think together what they form is this idea that, you know, this push for women as mothers.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe there's different kinds of mothers now, but that's still being held up as the most important role.
Mm-hmm. And then jumping a little back to the Asian American woman, like, what's kind of the utilization of art for the Asian American
community? Oh, well, as egg donors. And I assume for sperm donors too, although I haven't checked that. You can check, you know, when you go through the sperm banks, you can narrow down your search by race and ethnicity. Mm-hmm. So Asian's definitely on there. So I assume they're recruiting for Asian sperm donors, but egg donors even more so,
because mm-hmm.
You see those targeted ads. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, I assume that. And I'm assuming this, I haven't seen any data because you can't really get the data, that if you think about sort of who can afford this, then, you know, at least a certain segment of the Asian American population has enough wealth
mm-hmm.
to use these technologies and sort of fit the profile of those who might want to.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I certainly know on an anecdotal basis people who have, but... I don't know in any sort of
numbers.
Yeah, I don't have numbers or trends.
Huh. That's interesting. Why do they not collect any like data on it? Is it just like a privacy issue or like the companies just kind of like keep their data?
Yeah, the CDC requires that fertility clinics report what they call success rates.
Mm-hmm.
And they mean live births. So they have to report the number of IVF cycles, whether or not surrogacy was used,
mm-hmm.
source of the eggs, but they don't have to report any demographic information.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So like race and everything is
right.
Left out.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Because that would be an interesting...
Yeah, sure would.
Thing to look at.
I mean, I guess you could kind of... The only other way to go about it was to look to see who the agencies are marketing to.
Mm-hmm.
And they have become... They started to become... more multiracial, and there are niches.
Really? Oh.
Yeah, there are niches.
Because I know in Dorothy Roberts' book, she goes through the, like, the fertility clinics, and she wrote it in, like, 99, so it was a while ago, but she says that all the fertility clinics, like, images and, like, front pages of their home pages are, like, white babies with, like, blue eyes.
Yeah, yeah, and I think to a large extent that's still true, but, the ones I've seen, there are some, and I think they're sort of niche clinics, mm-hmm. so they're aiming at, there are some that are aiming at the so-called gaybies. So they're set up for gay and lesbian couples, and some mm-hmm. are set up for multiracial families or mm-hmm. More diverse communities. Mm-hmm. That. But the mainstream, I think, is still, it's white babies on the front web page.
Yeah. It was a little creepy. I was, like, looking through different websites, and I'm from the Midwest, and so I was, like, looking through local Minnesota fertility clinics.
Oh, yeah,
all white families with all white babies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like, I think if you go to L.A., New York,
mm-hmm. Bigger cities.
Yeah, San Francisco,
yeah, yeah,
then
yeah.
you're going to find those niche markets. And globally, mm-hmm. You'll find them. As well.
What did you call them?
Gabies. That was a term that was being used for a while for clinics that were sort of going for the that market.
They mix like those names, gay with like everything, Gaysian, Gabies.
Yeah.
Okay. But you know, with like the recent Supreme Court ruling, do you think that market's also gonna expand for, you know, gay and lesbian couples?
Yeah, I mean, gay and lesbian couples have been having children without marriage,
mm-hmm.
But I think the marriage will help validate that use, and it might help pry open the doors of some of the clinics, because mm-hmm. Some clinics have been saying no.
Don't some countries also have restrictions?
Yeah, yeah, and that might change. So in a sense, it might validate gay family formation.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it'll expand it, but I think it'll also, like I said, hopefully help reduce some of the exclusion from some mm-hmm. of the clinics.
Okay.
We'll see.
I mean, personally, from within my family would not be, like, okay with me being a surrogate mother or, like, donating eggs. Like, is there kind of, like, an Asian cultural thing, too? Like, I know I've seen articles on stuff like that, but I don't know.
I don't know. For one thing, it depends on... It probably depends on which Asian culture you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really hard because we're so...
Diverse.
Yeah, diverse just within the category of Asian. I think it's really hard to say. I mean, I think probably to the extent that now such a huge percentage of Asian Americans are first or second generation.
Mm-hmm.
And just in that sense... that, you know, maybe less willing to accept the idea of being a surrogate, mm-hmm. being an egg donor. That might be true.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, I don't know. Because, I mean, even the religious diversity within the communities is...
It's pretty... what's wanted to
be. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's all over the place. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and a reporter asked me that. Was it last year or the year before?
Uh-huh.
Because the LA Times did a story on... Ooh, it's 407. On the Asian egg market.
Oh, okay. Maybe I'll look that article up.
Yeah, it's just one, you know, they just did this sort of, I guess, human interest piece.
Uh-huh.
Because they had noticed the ads or something like that, too.
Yeah, they're a little creepy.
I bet. We want your eggs.
Yeah.
So what feels creepy about it?
I guess the fact that it's an Asian woman.
It's so specific.
Yeah, and that it's in, like, a school newspaper was a little weird, too.
Yeah.
So it's next to, like, student articles and, like, you know, local pizza places, and then it says, seeking Asian female eggs. And I'm like, what is this? Like, this is so disturbing. Yeah, I think it's just the fact that it was, like, targeted towards Asian women, just because...
And that's noticeable.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then, you know, on top of, like... And then I'm, like, super race hypersensitive,
yeah.
And so I'm like, is this, you know, analogous to classified ads looking for Asian women, like, as, you know, submissive partners? Like,
right.
What is this for? Like,
yeah.
I don't understand, so...
Because what they want is your race.
Yeah.
Right? They want a
yeah,
racial
yeah.
identity.
It's always at the top. It's Asian female, and then they list the SAT scores they want, and, you know, like, other things like that, and so... It's like, oh, wow, like, I could do this, but it's just a little weird. Yeah.
Yeah.
A little weird.
Yeah, I bet. I bet. Yeah. Yeah, I ask my students, I go, where do you see the most ads? And they say Craigslist.
Oh.
So I guess they're all over Craigslist.
For eggs?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, my friends always, like, you know, show me the article. They're like, hey, Drew, you make $10,000. And they, like, joke about it. But it's
still creepy.
So, yeah, it's a little creepy. Yeah, so do you think that's, like, the future? Like, where do you think everything's headed?
I don't. Oh, that's a good question. Where do I think everything's headed? Well, I don't want to be. So to me, it would be pessimistic to think that we're going to go to. That we're going in that direction where everything is totally free market, anything goes. Because my version of the market is that all these social categories will govern the market.
Mm-hmm.
That it's not a new market's not a neutral place, and in a sense, it will exacerbate all the kind of racial and gender selections that we already have.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to be that pessimistic and think that's where it's going. I don't know. I guess the sort of the most promising parts of it to me have been in family formation by gay and lesbian couples, mm-hmm. So the use of ARTs there. Because in that sense, the use of ARTs has had a liberatory effect. And so I think it's important to think about how do you use these technologies in a way that enhances relationships and communities at the same time. So I guess that's sort of the counter to the market for me.
The bright side.
But I don't know which one's going to win. It'll probably just evolve into something completely different. Some new technology will come up.
Yeah, you can check back, like,
yeah.
10 years from now.
Yeah, it'll turn out I'm completely wrong.
Yeah, well, I think that's all the questions I have, so.
Okay, good.
Yeah, if we can just, like, I actually brought a camera, so if you can, like, take a photo.
Oh, okay.
And then.
Oh, good, I should have worn something else.
Oh, no, it's okay.